Right, so the damage is really important for the small farmers in Africa. Also, the mite has a great reproductive capacity. It means that it can also, it's a parthenogenetic mite. It can develop resistance to acaricides very fast. So, other thing, the tomato is planted all year long, and there's also other solanaceous plant that can be used as a host for the mite. And for this reason, I think the classical biocontrol approach is the most interesting one because it's a self-regulating, it's a simple and adaptive, and it's an inexpensive means of intervention. We have done some research in Brazil, and also we found the pathogen Nosegaides floridana in Peru, in Argentina, and semi-arid place of Brazil, also in the coast. And the only other natural enemy associated with this mite is a predatory mite. It's a phytosaid mite. The name is Phytoseudus longipes, and this was only found in one small area in Brazil. And actually, this predatory mite is already in Africa. Was sent, you know, it was introduced to Africa. It's probably gonna be is being released right now. And this is another example where you have, you know, a acarologist working the project, and although it seems that the fungus is the most efficient one, but we need to do a lot of studies before we introduce, and then the, you know, people start to release predators before we are actually able to introduce the pathogen. We have some questions when you start to work with this. The first one is this: when you collect in the field the tomato red spider mite infected with Nosegaides, we also find other spider mites infected, such as the two-spotted spider mite, and here the Tetranychus ludens, another red mite. So you want to know if the same fungus was infecting different host species, because although I mentioned that there are more than 16 species of spider mite infected by the same fungus Nosegaides floridana, nobody have ever checked if the same strain is able to survive in different hosts. So we compare this with seven species of spider mite, different genus, and what we see is that usually the fungus only cause high mortality on the same host where it was isolated. For example, here the pathogen that isolated from Tetranychus evans caused 53% mortality to the tomato red spider mite only. And although you see here 14 or 9% infection, you usually don't see mummification. It means that the pathogen is not able to produce a lot of conidia. They probably have a broad host range in terms of they can survive in another host, but they're probably going to be efficient against only a single host. Same thing here. You know, this pathogen that was collecting tomato plant on two-spotted spider mite, and it's mostly efficient against the two-spotted spider mite. The other question we had is just Solanaceous plant, they have a lot of plant defense compounds against herbivore. So they have all the glycoalkaloids, all the compounds that affect the pests and also the natural enemies. For example, two-spotted spider mite has been controlled in, by phytoseed predatory mites in many countries. For example, Phytoseulus persimilis is the most used predatory mite against the two-spotted spider mite in many places, except on Solanaceous. No, this predator doesn't work very well in Solanaceous plant. So you want to see if the fungus would be able also to control the red spider mite in different Solanaceous plants. We compare this with on Solano americano. This is the nightshade plant. It's an important crop in Africa also. In Kenya, they eat the leaves of the nightshade plant, although in many places just consider weed. Eggplant, pepper, tomato, wild tomato, and then we see that in most cases we have a very high infection level of Tetranychus evansi, the tomato spider mite. And although we have some difference in terms of mummification, it seems that all those hosts will be good alternate hosts for the mite and also for the pathogen. We're currently doing some epizootiological studies. We don't have much data now, but this is just the data from the northeast part of the country, and we see always see that after the fungus show up, you see a lot of infection, and then the population crash, and most of them might die here. So Of course, in this project, at least the cassava green white pot had been going on for a long time. There are many people that collaborate here. So I just list the name of the institutions that are collaborating the project. The cassava green white project is coordinated by the International Institute for Tropical Agriculture and Cornell University in Brazil, Embrapa, and University of São Paulo, and also the International Center for Tropical Agriculture in Colombia. The Tomato Red Spider Mite Project is it's coordinated by the International Center for Insect Physiology in Kenya, and there are two Brazilian institutions here, the universities that are participating in this project. So we're planning for the next year to start the process to introduce the Snellsiogyces floridana strains from Brazil into Kenya to release to control the tomato red spider mite. Okay, that's it. We're trying to do that, you know, but I think we're really far from getting any result. I mean, this fungus is very difficult to grow in artificial media, and actually only grow in very expensive media. So even when you start, when you get some conidia from in vitro culture, the conidia is not very, it's not virulent. So we still, I think we're really far from. We're trying to do this more as conservation. So it has been in use, for example, in cotton to control aphid species in the United States is just to monitor the infection level. What they do is just, you know, they collect samples from the field. If you have like 5% infection, and then you don't need to spray anything because you know that the fungus is going to control the aphid, the cotton aphid, for example. So we're trying to also do this, and I think it's really important is to manage the crop in terms of not using fungicide. That's what we've seen. We have seen a lot of spider mite problem in Brazil now. You know, after you get the rust fungus disease in soybean, and then you start to have problems spider mite because people are spraying a lot of fungicide. And then you go and check, you see that you are disrupting the fungal pattern that was controlling spider mite. In most cases, I think you don't have many species of spider mite that are really important pest, except in those cases when you have, you know, system that's not balanced. Here or in Europe?
I live in the U.S.
In the U.S.
I live in the U.S. still.
Okay.
You'll have to double check on that, but I've been reading that recently in the literature. So that would make a very nice match, depending on if that price is for similar species as well as your red tomato.
Well, it's good to know. I mean, you just submit a paper, and you know, a reviewer comments something like that. So okay, well, even predator mite, they don't work very well on tomato plants. Or so I didn't know that.
In the U.S. with the Neosaegides with cotton aphid, there were sort of within season attempts to jumpstart epizootics earlier in the season. Are there any grassroots efforts in some of these places where it's been introduced to take plants or infected plants at peak epizootic levels and move them to other geographic regions? You could do the initial inoculation.
Yeah, I don't know. The cotton aphid project also, I mean, they have done some classical biocontrol here in the United States, just moving the pattern from one place to another. I don't remember exactly what the state. I mean, I know the Arkansas had been used. They tried to introduce, I'm not sure if it's in California or what, and they were able to start epizootic. So it's another option also to start, you know, early epizootic during field release.
California, the environment wasn't right. What they were trying to do is the epizootic started in southern U.S. Sweep up to Arkansas.
Yeah.
But in a situation where the environment's correct, there's just inoculation effort, it might be interesting to.
So this is I believe that's the way to go. I mean, if you think how the epizootic start in the field, usually people tend to say that you only have high infection level when the density of the host is high. I mean, it's a density dependent manner. So my impression is that usually the pathogens in the soil as a rest spore. So how the pathogen is going to, you know, come from the soil into the plant? You know, maybe a drop of water during the rain, or maybe when the infestation is high, so some mites are trying to disperse with the wind, as I just showed, and they fall on the ground and they contaminate and come up to the leaf. So that's why people sometimes say, okay, this is the density dependent, you know, relationship. So if you could get the pathogen from the field earlier to the crop, so you, I think the pathogen would do a good job in terms of controlling. So that's what they're saying, seeing now in Norway, so in strawberry. But in this case, the pathogen overwinter hibernating females of the mite. So when the female comes to the plant, it's already bringing the pathogen. So the epizootic started much earlier. So that's something you have to learn.
Most of our information on multi-trophic interactions involves studies above ground, but as we now know, both above ground and below ground interactions can influence population structure. We carried out a study on a specific plant herbivore carnivore system that's important in southeastern U.S. that links both above ground and below ground. The above ground species is Micropleurus chrysepes, a solitary and specialized endoparasite of the heliophane complex. The herbivore is Heliocoverpacea larvae, or the corn earworm. And the plant is Gossypium hirsutum, specifically the leaves of cotton. The below ground species are the roots of cotton and Melodogyne incognita, or the root knot nematode, which is a sedentary gall forming species that causes stunting of the plant and other adverse effects, and has also been shown to sequester nitrogen in their roots, presumably at a cost to the nitrogen in the shoots.
The olive fruit fly, Bacteriocina oli, is new invasive species to California. It was first trapped in 1998 in Southern California. And just within a few years, it has spread and established in almost in all olive growing areas in California. And this map shows the fly distribution based on a survey conducted by California Department of Food and Agriculture in 2002. So it's just only 4 years. And particularly along the coastal area, the olive are heavily infested. And so the growth does not mainly rely on the spray of G420, which is a spinosad-based fruit fly bait. And it is recommended for them to spray like once per week or at least twice per month during the olive maturing and harvesting season, that is from late June to November. So then I have to spray like 20, 30 times. So because of the high control cost, the fly has severely impacted the olive industry in California. We are mainly, like now, we are focused on the classical biological control by importing and evaluating some pesticides from Africa. But in our lab at the Dr. Marshall Johnson at UC Riverside, we also try to quantify some biotic factors that might potentially influence the fly survival, particularly in the California Central Valley during the summer. The first factor is high temperature. If anyone in this room, if you've been in Central California during summer, probably with all the ecology of the heat. The temperature is extremely hot. The temperature could frequently raise up to 100 degrees Fahrenheit for a couple of days consecutively, sometimes in some years, maybe 1-2 weeks. And some previous studies have been done also at the Dr. Johnson's lab indicating that the olive fruit fly daughter were reduce their activity when the temperature is up to 95 degrees. And they also try to keep the away from the heat. So they might also need to just pause to in order to find the refugee from the heat. Just to give you a sense of how hot it could be in the Central Valley during the summer in California. Using the GIS, we are able to mapping the frequency of high temperature that is high or equal to 100 degrees for 3 consecutive days. So I wanted to notice here the Peru color indicating their main olive orchards in the Central Valley, and the all the other different color indicating the different frequency of the high temperature. So I want to notice the yellow color I mean, this kind of high temperature frequency happened like 3 to 5 years out of 10 years. This is just by July 15, and then by August 15, it happened almost to the whole central valley. So it is extremely hot. The second factor could be the for the sources. We also some previous studies have been done in our lab show that the fry couldn't survive with all the water particularly. And they can only like survive 1 to 2 days if they provide of any food, particularly water, because they intend to remain